Hello, I'm Mark Peterson, and this is the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast. We're in season two of the podcast, and this is episode 7. This is where we love giving well. Today's interview is the podcast I've been waiting to produce ever since I began. Greg Penoyer is a dear friend, and through our friendship, he has influenced my thinking on philanthropy more than anyone else. So I'm excited to finally share this with you. Greg wears several different hats. He's been leading the Roundtable since inception in 2012, a Canadian membership organization for philanthropists involved in faith-based giving. His full-time job has been with Cartus, a think tank that has launched his unique project, Faith in Canada 150, a celebration of the Canadian sesquicentennial and the often ignored role various religions play in the social fabric of our country. Finally, he has fundraised on the side for an inspiring arts and culture initiative I'll let him describe to you. My interview with Greg was long, so I've decided to break it into two parts. You get one part today, and next episode will be the conclusion of our interview. But enough from me now. Let's hear from Greg. Greg Penoyer, welcome to the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast today.
It's good to be here.
I can hear an owl hooting in the background.
Well, we had a choice between a crying baby inside or the hooting owl outside, and I thought this might just be a little gentler on the ears.
Thank you for joining us. We'll have you here with the owl as well.
Great. Still no guarantees about the baby, though.
Okay.
this house is his castle, and he goes where he wishes.
Greg, I've wanted to have you on this podcast ever since I started doing them, and I'm so pleased that you can be a part of it today.
Yeah, I've been waiting in fear and trembling for this invitation.
You're one of the most thoughtful people I know on philanthropy, and I think you have a lot to offer us. How did you get connected to philanthropy? What's that story?
Well, I came at it from the other side as a fundraiser for years. I started in 1993 fundraising for the Center for Cultural Renewal that we launched in 93. And it just grew from there, and through fundraising for them and other charitable endeavors. I'm a bit of a social entrepreneur and started a number of different charitable initiatives. And through that, got to know a number of really wonderful philanthropic families in Canada. And it was through my relationship with them that I started to see possibilities and opportunities for care and service towards those families.
Good. And is that how you ended up with this roundtable that you've been a part of here?
Yeah, I became various levels of friendship and good acquaintances and relationships with people in the philanthropic world. And through that, you begin to recognize opportunities for service towards these families. They're very, very busy in their businesses and their family lives and their church commitments. And I saw a tremendous opportunity for service to these families by helping them consider their philanthropy and exploring issues and ideas and practices that might assist them in their philanthropic endeavors. As you get to know them, you see both the joys and the sorrows of their philanthropic work.
What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, the joy of giving is obvious on the faces of so many of these people. They just take such a pleasure in being generous, and yet at the same time, the responsibilities, the pressures upon them from the growing charitable world in Canada. You know, you begin to see them feel the weight of their work. And when that is combined with, you know, their other responsibilities and making the wealth that they give away and caring for their families as they navigate issues of wealth and transfer of wealth, and how do we make sure that the next generation understands generosity and is responsible and preserves the wealth, all these big questions that are on their shoulders. Plus the growing number of charities in Canada, which are, you know, once the word gets out that somebody's a giver, all of a sudden they start hearing from people that they never knew before, and the pressure is on. So the roundtable was constructed as you and I, in particular, through our friendship and through our work together, you on the philanthropic side, me on the charitable side, as we began to explore how do we serve these families and help them enhance their sense of fulfillment and their sense that they're doing something meaningful and accomplishing something that has sustainable influence on the world. The roundtable was created to help them achieve those lofty goals and ideals.
So what do you do exactly? Maybe help us understand that better.
Sure. Well,
with the roundtable, I mean.
Yeah. Our vision is to inspire a renewed era of Christian philanthropy that's defined by compassion, joy, sustainability, and in particular, innovation, new ideas, new ways of doing things. We, you know, anybody who's read even a portion of the books that have come out on the charitable sector these last few years will recognize that there's lots of charitable work that's being done that isn't helpful and isn't good. So we want to help navigate these and create a movement of Christian philanthropists that are fulfilled and joyful and doing work that's sustainable and innovative. And we do this by the provision of kind of relationship-based member benefits that seek to inspire and renew and inform the philanthropic efforts of Christians as they seek to make a dramatic contribution to the enrichment of society, the creation of culture, and care for the common good.
So you get together on a regular basis with these people?
Yeah, we have a number of levels of initiatives. One that is becoming probably the most important thing that we do is these dinners that are facilitated by Rod Wilson. We gather 10 guests at a dinner table, and we break bread together, and we begin to explore some of the more intimate and challenges that these families face and these couples face as they seek to make a difference in the world. And as they listen to each other and learn from each other, it's just amazing the response to the evening. They find out that they're not alone in their apprehensions and their concerns. But they also are inspired, and their joy is enhanced by the fact that that they have people who are walking the same journey as they are in many ways. And there's always a great joy in knowing that you're not on your own in the midst of these challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You also host certain trips as well through the year, don't you?
Well, we do. The dinners are becoming the kind of anchor. And then from that, we do the regional roundtables, which are more best practices things, issues. We focus on issues like transfer of wealth, dealing with the challenges of that, or how do you pass on a legacy of generosity and philanthropy to the next generation? You've participated with us in the idea of strategic philanthropy. How do you ensure that your philanthropy is strategic, is having a real impact, is sustainable, is making a difference? What are the best practices? Or as Rod Wilson in his book says, what is the liturgy of philanthropy? And how do we engage in that liturgy? So that we do that through the regional roundtables. And then every once in a while, we will have a trip somewhere in the world that we think provides insight, inspiration, encouragement to the members of the roundtable. And some of these issues are not directly related to philanthropy. One of the things that is clear in the roundtable is we recognize that philanthropy is a holistic thing. Your understanding of giving isn't shaped simply through the silo of economics. Your giving is shaped by who you are as a whole person, your understanding of yourself and your place in the world, your understanding of who your neighbor is and whether or not you have a responsibility to them, your understanding of issues, whether it's human trafficking or the Palestinian-Israel conflict, or, you know, what really diminishes poverty in a certain part of the world. Knowing these things, understanding these issues shapes your philanthropy, shapes whether or not you give or how you give or what you give to. Mm. Your relationship with God shapes your philanthropy. Your relationship with money shapes philanthropy. Your desire for legacy, whether or not you want a legacy or don't. And your recognition of philanthropy as power, as a very powerful thing in the world. These shape how people give. Some people are afraid of the power of philanthropy, and therefore they're either don't give or give apprehensively or are nervous about their giving because they see its potential to do both good and ill in the world. Mm-hmm. So we recognize that the whole person, that one's philanthropy is shaped by the whole person and not just, you know, a certain set of practices related to philanthropy. And so we seek to serve and inform all those areas. And so these larger events that we do, well, they're not larger in numbers. We do everything small, probably no more than 20 people in a room. But the tours that we have done to the seven churches of Revelation that we're doing this September to Oxford and Cambridge, exploring the Inkling, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, Barfield, Charles Williams, as really prophets for the 21st century. These things we know inform our members' perspectives of the world and of their faith and cannot help but shape their philanthropy. Mm. We'll be doing a trip probably to Palestine, Israel, where we will look at both sides of this issue very clearly and as thoroughly as we can in the course of 7 or 8 days. And ensure that our members have a more complete understanding of the circumstances there. We'll do that in Cambodia, and we'll do that on issues related to human trafficking and poverty. But those will come over time.
That sounds great. I really hope that anybody that's listening to this podcast that could become a member of the Roundtable will do so. You have to join to be part of this? Is that
how it works? It is a membership-based society, and we're about to launch our website this fall. It's been a little bit of a long journey, the website, but that'll be coming out this fall. And in there will be all the information related to cost of membership. It's going to be pretty minimal, the cost, but we're very much a you pay for services approach to this. And we think that given the growth of the roundtable in the last year, that people are finding that our services are worth it. So that's great news for us.
You and I have had many conversations over the years.
Have we ever?
Inspired. We have. But we won't get into all of that right now. But I was actually leading up to the book that we've often talked about, James Davis and Hunters, To Change the World. You were the first one who gave me my copy and helped me start to think along those lines. Would you care to just share with the listeners the premise of that book and how perhaps it has shaped your thinking on philanthropy?
Let me just say that all theories have their strengths and their weaknesses. And I think James Davison's Hunter's book is exceptional. But, you know, there are worthy minds out there who have challenged him on particular issues. But I think in general, his theory is quite accurate. And his he writes in his book that if you really want to change the world, then you have to engage in the activities that actually change the world. And I think, I can't say for sure, but certainly as I read his book, I wondered if it was born out of the fact that in the last 40 years, since the 70s, mid-70s, literally billions of dollars has been spent by Christians in trying to preserve, we'll use in this case American culture, but I think it's fair to say millions have been spent in Canada to preserve the kind of Christian elements of our society. And yet after all that expenditure of money and energy, both countries are less Christian than they were back in the mid-70s. And I think that's obvious to everybody. So I think as he considered this, he began to explore, well, how do you actually contribute to the shape of culture? And most Christians have gotten involved in very, very important things. Care for the poor, care for the destitute, you know, Christian schools, other initiatives within the country that are very important, but they haven't been the things that actually shape the culture as a whole. It was interesting, I think of Oz Guinness, who said once that when the Jewish community wanted to influence American culture, they moved to New York, Washington, D.C., and Hollywood. And when Christians wanted to influence American society, they moved to Colorado Springs and Orlando. And in a sense, what that is a, you know, we've gotten involved in very important things, but they haven't been the things that have or the places that have really shaped that really shaped culture. James Davison Hunter says that there are institutions in a society that are culture-shaping institutions. The arc of change, the length of time it takes to change a culture through those institutions, is very long. It's generational. You can't measure change within weeks or months or years. And I think in part that's part of the Christian problem, is we have a very deep commitment to steward. I think that's reasonable. I think it's good. And sometimes in this commitment to stewardship, we've wanted to measure the value of what we've done, and we measured it through outcomes. And if we can't see outcomes, we sometimes don't fund those things. So why would you fund, let me just throw it out there, Image Journal, a journal on art, faith, and mystery? I mean, how does that change culture? Can we measure that? Well, you can't measure it in a variety of years, but you can measure it in a generation. You can measure it over time as an institution like, a major think tank in a Ivy League university. You can see the influence that many of these institutions have had in Canada and the U.S. over generations of presence and work and seeding the thinking of a culture. And we have not been involved at that level. We generally, and when I say we, I mean we as a Christian community, we have gotten involved more at a kind of grassroots delivery level where we can actually measure the difference that we're making. But true cultural transformation is a slow, long arc of change process. And Davison Hunter in his book calls us back to engaging those institutions of culture and recognizing the patience and the long-term commitment to making a difference in the world. The roundtable exists not just to introduce this, but I mean, that's part of what we're doing. I get our call to care for the poor and the destitute and the marginalized and those who are despised in the world. I think we need to be the first people there. I remember, I think it was Stephen Lewis who said that he had to rethink this whole Christian contribution to society because of how the Christians were first and foremost at the responding to the AIDS crisis in the world. And he had said publicly how proud he was of the church Christian community in Canada for its response to this issue, because we were leading the way. So I think it's important that we're on the ground on these things. But as we consider what we want to do, if we're going to preserve a generous culture, then we have to preserve the culture that creates that generosity. And that is where the, you know, that's where for many of us who are practical people begin to, our eyes glaze over and we think, oh no, giving to a think tank or giving to an art institute or giving to an art journal or, you know, a film, I mean, a good film.
Yes.
There are many films out there that have no cultural influence at all, but there are many films out there that are so profoundly good that they have shaped our culture. People like Gregory Wolfe and Malcolm Guite and David Goa and others can speak much better to why art is such an essential to the preservation of a culture than I can. But art softens the edge of truth. Mm. Art is a vessel that carries truth in a way that people can hear and see their humanity in the truth. Sometimes truth is this kind of two-edged sword that we wield back and forth in a society. But I think mm-hmm. art can actually bring out the beauty of truth and the beauty in us as we explore truth. And there's this very lovely... Malcolm Guite has just come out. He's a British poet and priest, an Anglican priest out of Cambridge. He just has published a book on Samuel Taylor Coleridge called The Mariner. And it's definitely in relationship to his major poem. But he says, in this quote, he says, Coleridge advances the beautiful, suggestive idea that the poetic imagination can hold open for us a shape or a space we have yet to grow into. The great works of art and literature are, as it were, making room for our future insights, giving us the shapes, the stories, the images into which the undeveloped antenna of our inner life can grow.
That's one of the most hopeful quotes I've ever heard. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, art, literature. I mean, just look in our past and look who we are today. We've been shaped by art and literature over generations, over centuries.
Right.
But again, it's one of those measurable things. If you can't measure the change, we're not going to support it. And we are losing the Christian, not only patina, but also the Christian substance of our culture, because we have neglected the long arc of cultural change that comes through the arts, through literature, through think tanks, through institutions. And art is this wonderful place that reminds us of our humanity on the one hand, and inserts truth and beauty and good into that imagination of ours. And it's we need to restore it. And it's, we're moving into a culture that is is opposed to the kind of, is not going to be listening to the preaching, but it'll be looking to, it wants to see us, doesn't want to hear us, wants to see mm-hmm. the truth. It just doesn't want to hear about the truth. It wants to see mm-hmm. the good and the beautiful. It just doesn't want to hear about it. And I think that's why we as Christians need to capture once again the arts and other culture-shaping elements of our life.
One example that comes to my mind is the initiative that you were behind, the U mm-hmm. exhibition. And I know that this has brought you a lot of joy and a lot of sorrow over mm-hmm. the years, just because there hasn't been an appetite by the faith-based philanthropic community to get behind that at the level that it needed. Help us just understand what that story is and your part in helping to birth this idea. And then what you think is going to happen in the future, yeah. perhaps, around that issue.
Well, the exhibition was called the U exhibition, just the letter U, U being that common letter that we use in emails and texts referring to the other. And it was an exhibition about what it meant, what it means to be human. What was unique about it is that we were using 75 of the greatest first-tier works of art on the life and parables of Jesus to explore this question, what does it mean to be human? Western civilization.
What kinds of works of art are you referring to?
Say The Woman Caught in Adultery by Cranach the Elder, The Woman at the Well, The Good Samaritan by Van Gogh, Rembrandt's Prodigal Son. These great works of art on the life and parables of Jesus that have unveiled for us who we are. One of the challenges with the church and the Christian community is we have seen the Gospels as an unveiling to the world and to us of who God is through Jesus. But Jesus was equally, God came as incarnate human flesh in Jesus, not only to reveal himself to us, but reveal us to ourselves. What does it mean to be fully human? And that is equally the message of the Gospels and the life of Jesus. Say to us, this is who you are and who you were called to be. And so we wanted to capture that element as found in these great works of art. You know, the largest collection of art in the world is on the biblical story. I mean, think of the institutions that any one of us have gone to over the last number of years. The Met, the Lachman, L.A., the great museums of the world, the vast majority of art is on the biblical story. And out of that is a significant portion of that is on Jesus, the life of Jesus and his parables. And these have for centuries kind of spoken to us about who we are. And, the West is made up of three stories, the story from Athens and the story from Rome and also the story from Jerusalem. And we live in a culture of amnesia that is forgetting, in particularly the story of Jerusalem. And we wanted to create an exhibition that just didn't preach this message, but actually said that this story speaks to who you are, speaks to who your neighbor is, and it unveils for us the West's understanding of the dignity of the human person. I mean, when the UN Declaration of Human Rights was written, it was written by three Christians, Malik from a Maronite Christian from Lebanon, John Humphreys, a Catholic, devout Catholic from McGill University, and Mrs. Roosevelt. And they drafted and wrote this beautifully written document about who we are as human beings. And it is a reflection of the gospel and of the life and teachings of Jesus. And so we wanted to capture that in a major exhibition. Now, actually, we did get a lot of support, Mark, over the years for this. And we had just incredibly wonderful people coming on side and being captured by this. Our greatest challenge was finding a museum that would show it. We even had people say, when you find a museum, we'll make a substantial gift to this. And I get their caution and their care in the way that they approach this. But we could not find a museum that would take the risk. And partly that's kind of the secularization of the museums over decades, where anything that smacks too much of a religious message is avoided. I should say that David Goa from the Royal Museum of Alberta was the curator for this, is the curator for this exhibition. And it comes out of his very successful exhibition in the year 2000 called Anno Domini, Jesus Through the Centuries, which he did at the Royal Museum, which became the most successful exhibition in the history of the museum. So even though there was a reluctance on the part of the museum to show it because of its religious nature, it ended up being attended by Jews and Muslims and Goths and all kinds of people from across the spectrum who were fascinated by this story of Jesus in Western time. And since that time, other museums, the Met, National Gallery in London, did Seeing Salvation, one of the top 10 exhibitions in the history of the museum, all on the death and resurrection of Jesus. So I think there's a recovery and a coming back to recognizing, exploring the issue of meaning in paintings. What were they meant? What do they mean? And what are they saying to us? So this exhibition is about meaning. It's about taking this story of the life and parables of Jesus through art and exploring what it says to us about who we are and who our neighbor is and our responsibility to ourselves and to each other. It's online in a much smaller rendition of 25 images, and it's called youencounter.org. Beautifully done by friends of ours in Vancouver, Don and Rana Chisholm, Dossier Creative, and just a beautiful work that they've done on our behalf. So we're grateful for that.
And then there is a possible future exhibition happening, right?
Yes, we actually, you talked about the difficulty of this. There was a great sadness a few years ago when we realized that we couldn't go on, spending money trying to find a museum because we just were not able to find one. So we essentially, after the launch of the website, shut our efforts down. And then in January of this year, a museum that we can't really mention yet has indicated interest. We're working with them. It's a new, brand new, very significant museum in the States that's about to open. And we think that there might be interest there, and we're very much looking forward to to developing a partnership with them. And just if there's anybody listening who hasn't heard about this yet and you've supported our exhibition, we'll be speaking to you personally once we get a final yes from the museum. We haven't wanted to raise the profile of this too much until we knew for sure that the museum was interested. So there's hope, and we're very excited by that.
Thank you, Greg, for joining us today. It's always inspiring to be with you. Being friends with Greg continues to challenge me in how I view philanthropy. It can be easy to industrialize one's giving. We can become consumed with measuring impact,
believing that an investment of dollars will produce the needed social change. There is some truth in this, but I think there's more to it than that. In philanthropy, there's an opportunity to also create beauty and uncover our own humanity. My hope is that in my own giving portfolio, and also in yours, that we will always hold back a portion for extravagant giving for arts and cultural initiatives. Take a look at what Greg is involved with and connect to the works he cited in this interview by reviewing the show notes to this episode. Changing the topic, I need your help. If you know of someone who should be interviewed for this podcast, I'd like you to reach out to me and make the suggestion or help me connect to that person. It might even be you. Send me an email at strongerphilanthropy@gmail.com. That's it for now, but before you go, if you take a moment to subscribe to this podcast, you won't miss any more episodes. We're on iTunes and other apps. Also, if you haven't read it yet, my book, Love Giving Well, Philanthropy as Pilgrimage, is available on my website at strongerphilanthropy.ca/book. Thanks for joining us in our quest to love giving well. Buen Camino.